The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. And, so I wanted to talk today a little bit about what is English is sometimes called precepts, and there's no really good word in Pali that translates precepts back into the Buddhist language, but we translate something from the Pali into the English word precepts. And the precepts are an aspect of Buddhist ethics or virtue, and the tradition is that the trainings of Buddhism. Buddhism offers trainings for people more than beliefs to believe. It's trainings to engage in. And that there are three sets of trainings. And the first set of training is a training in virtue. The second is a training in meditation. And the third is a training in wisdom or insight. And so the first, the virtue, is seen as the foundation for doing meditation practice. And meditation practice is seen as a foundation for developing penetrating insight. And so, as Buddhism has come to the West, as many of you know, we have this little bit upside down. We have the nightstand Buddhists who are focusing on the insight, the wisdom part, first and foremost, all these wonderful ideas. But then, if it's just, you know, from books, they can be inspiring, but it usually doesn't go very deep, even though it can seem profound as you're reading it. But then next week you wonder, what was that about? And then often here in the West, we practice meditation before any real concern with ethics or virtue. The classic thing would be you would actually train, be concerned with your virtue, your ethics, and that somehow creates a good state of mind, state of heart for you that makes it easier to meditate. Because if you are feeling somehow morally challenged, it's usually harder to meditate. And morally challenged is maybe not the right word, to use the word moral. So the precepts are said to be five, and these are usually the most basic ethical guidelines that are given for lay people in our tradition. And so this training in virtue is often, people point to these five, living by these five precepts as being the kind of the very most basic aspect of virtue. And the five precepts are not to kill, not to steal, not to engage in sexual misconduct, not to lie, and not to intoxicate yourself. That's approximately rough translation. Those five, and then it's very common when these are taught here in the West that the teachers will very quickly say, as I'm quickly going to say, that these are not commandments, because often in the Western kind of Judeo-Christian kind of context, people think, oh, like, that's like the Ten Commandments or something, or that these are you know, absolute moral obligations that you have to follow, because these rules, absolute universal rules, like, this is, you know, if you'd be a good Buddhist, you have to do this. And but there's no external authority in Buddhism. There's no, you know, great person up in the sky in heavens who decrees that this is what you should do. There is no external authority that way in Buddhism. The real authority is yourself, and so there is no one to tell you this is what you should do in Buddhism. But there still, Buddhism offers these five precepts. So that's what I kind of want to talk about today. But I want to give a little more introduction background for them. So precepts, or these, maybe the word precept is not the best translation. We'll get to that. But, you know, to have these kinds of ethical guidelines, it's fair to say, is there some principle behind them? Because sometimes only by understanding the principle that you can really understand how these guidelines should be applied. Because they can look like commandments, it can look like, it should be absolute in some way. Like for, when you get to sex, that's always interesting. What are the absolute rules around sex? Who can you and can't you? do things with. And religions in the world over have come down with very strict rules that we're still struggling with, trying to, some cultures trying to deal with these very strict guidelines. And then you happen to be someone who doesn't fit those guidelines or those rules and something, and then you feel, like you don't belong in your faith community because your kind of person is not recognized because of how you tend to do it, what you're interested in. So how is it in Buddhism? Is there a principle? Is there rules? But rather than looking at rules, I think it's very helpful to look at it from Buddhist point of view, that Buddhism offers a principle through which to understand these guidelines. And it's a very simple principle. This principle is a principle that can help you make your own moral evaluation. And the principle is the principle of not causing harm. And everything follows from there. So, I think the more interesting one, I think that's more controversial for most of people in our circles, because most of us don't go around killing and stealing. But the one that, around sexuality, so the rule is no sexual misconduct. And so how do you decide what is sexual misconduct? And in fact, you find Buddhists of all kinds of, different kinds of Buddhists who makes all kinds of statements about sex. So you have Buddhists who are puritanical and make strict rules and say things which some of you would cringe at hearing. But you remember that Buddhism is a huge, wide world religion, so you find everything in it. But generally, the consensus, I think, overall in Buddhism is that in looking at sexual behavior, knowing what kind of behavior to engage in and what not to engage in, it comes down to the issue of, is it causing harm? Is anybody harmed from that behavior? Is your sexual partner harmed? Are you harmed? Are the people in the community around that, harmed? Is there harm being created? Is someone being hurt? And the idea being that you don't want to cause harm. And that's kind of like one of the core Buddhist principles. That Buddhism is at its essence is about learning how not to cause harm. And freedom, we kind of advertise a lot in Buddhism, right? Like, liberation, freedom, it's like lofty terms. And you can ask, freedom, what does freedom mean? Freedom from what? Or freedom to do what? Freedom to do whatever you want? One of the ways of understanding liberation in Buddhism, it's liberation from being a person who causes harm. That the forces inside of you that could lead to causing harm no longer operating. That you're free, you're kind of liberated from that, you're released from that. And one of the persons that we want to become, where it's most noticeable that you stop becoming causing harm, is to yourself. And again, this is one of the core principles of Buddhism, is that what your responsibility for as a person is how you cause harm to yourself and how you cause harm to others. And is there intentional harm being made? So then there was a whole analysis in Buddhism that you're supposed to do with your own mindfulness practice to understand, are there ways in which you're causing harm? Are you causing, particularly to yourself? So if you're highly hypercritical of yourself and angry with yourself, then in a sense, you're your own enemy. You're kind of attacking yourself. Or if you are filled with hate for someone else and anger, in Buddhism we say you're also harming yourself in that process. If you're consumed with greed and lust, if you pay mindful attention to that movement inside of you, you can see that that causes harm to you, that you suffer because of it. And so the movement to become free of suffering in Buddhism it can be said, is a movement to become free of causing harm. And why that's important to word it that way is that causing harm implies that you have agency. Causing harm is you have some role in the action that's causing harm. Sometimes when you say become free of suffering, it seems too abstract for people. It's like, you know, I'm just suffering. I'm not responsible for my suffering. But part of the function of mindfulness practice is to help us understand, what am I contributing here to my suffering? What am I contributing to the way that I hurt? And what we see when we is our contribution is how we cause harm. Now, this is not supposed to be, you know, depressing. And, you know, fire and brimstone sermon here about how you're a terrible person because you're going around causing harm. But rather, it's supposed to be kind of a practical analysis of what we do and how we can become free of something. And it's a beautiful way, I think, of looking at our behavior as we go about our life in the world and realize and looking at it from this principle of, is there harm in this? And if there's no harm, no one's getting harmed whatsoever in the activity, then perhaps it's morally okay to do. So again, you know, this thing with sexuality. If there's no people getting harmed at all, then perhaps any kind of sexual expression is a fine thing. It's not a problem from a Buddhist point of view. As soon as someone is harmed in the process, then we're concerned. Because I think it's the nature of a relaxed, open, sensitive heart to be concerned about harm being created. And what happens, I believe, is that as people mature in Buddhism, in Buddhist practice, there's a stronger and stronger desire to avoid causing harm. And more heightened sensitivity to how harm is caused, occurs. So, so I said that these, as far as I'm concerned, no good word in the original Pali Buddhist language for the English word precepts. And so, how does this thing we call the five precepts appear in these early teachings of the Buddha? The precepts, the five precepts, don't appear a lot in the teachings of the Buddha. He didn't seem like it was like really that important for him in terms of frequency in which he taught it. It seems like he did teach it, but it seems like it was after his death that the Buddhist tradition picked these up as being and started talking about them much more as being the central precepts for lay people. Monastics have a whole other set. Monks have 227 precepts they have to follow. So lay people are just five. It's easy to remember. But one of the common ways in some of the early texts, the way the Buddha talked about these things now we call the five precepts, was as five virtues. And what that meant for the Buddha was at some point when you reach a certain degree of personal maturation, spiritual maturation, that these five virtues describe how you would behave. You're mature enough, you would be a kind of person who wouldn't kill, wouldn't steal, wouldn't engage in sexual misconduct, wouldn't lie, and wouldn't get involved in intoxication. So they're descriptive rather than prescriptive. And some people find that quite inspiring. It's inspiring in a world where there's a lot of harm being created left and right. You don't have to go very far to see, you know, how much harm suffering is inflicted on human beings. And it's quite remarkable to meet someone who you can feel trust in, confidence in, this person's not going to cause harm. And sometimes you can meet someone who's just really palpable, the fact, oh, this is a safe person. And it's a great gift that they give to others. And that's the second way in which the Buddha talked about these five precepts. He talked about them as five gifts. If you want to give the world a really good gift, make yourself a safe person. Because there are plenty of people who don't feel safe in our society. And to be able to be around people that you feel safe with is a beautiful thing. As I've said sometimes, there was this woman who came to Spirit Rock many years ago did a retreat, and then she left, and then she wrote a letter to Spirit Rock thanking Spirit Rock for her experience at the retreat. And she said, this is the first time in my life where I felt like I could walk around outdoors, out in the hills there and walking on property, where I felt safe. Because in my community where I live, being a woman, I don't feel safe going out at night and looking up at the stars and stuff. And this was a new experience for me. And not only did I feel safe walking around, it was the first time in my life where I slept in a place where my doors were not locked. Because the doors are not locked at the retreat centers. And she felt safe in this kind of environment. And perhaps many of you feel relatively safe in your communities, but there are plenty of people in this world who don't. So it's a gift to make yourself into such a person. The other way that the precepts are talked about is, and this is the word which is maybe closest to the word precept in English. It's a kind of a long word in Pali. It's sikkhapada. Sikkhapada. Sikkha means training. And pada means something like steps. So steps in the training. So these are five steps in the training, in training yourself to become spiritually mature. Five trainings in how to make yourself a safe person. Five trainings in how to become someone who's liberated and become free of causing harm. Another way of saying it, free of causing suffering. And so Buddhists will take on, some Buddhist practitioners will take on these five as something to train with. And that's a very important word, to train with, because training means that you probably need to train. The training is something you have to do over and over again, usually. You're learning a skill and you do it again and again. So it's perhaps that when you train yourself in the precepts, it means that you need to, there's some need you have, and guess what? That means you're probably not going to do it well at first. So when people commit themselves to the precepts in Buddhism, it's not such a big thing if you break your precept. It just means you're still training. And then, rather than being upset that you've broken the precept, the idea in Buddhism is to, since you're training, so let me see how I can do better next time. It's like my little 9-year-old son is learning, is in basketball team now. You know, and I was at a game today. It was pretty funny. What goes on there? And I've never seen referees with so much care and compassion and patience. You know, and they, you know, stopping and explaining very carefully. Or the referee is saying, you know, defense, go down. And so they make, you know, there's a lot of mistakes. But that's, you know, but they're training, they're learning. So they don't get upset about the mistakes, they just kind of train. So the spirit, I think, for many Buddhists is not to take the precepts on as these heavy moral obligations, but rather take them as something that that you're training with, and you'll do your best with it, and if you somehow come short, you know, don't treat that as like, you know, really lightly, but don't be burdened by it, but rather say, how can I do better in the future? So these five precepts, and if you think of them as being the precepts of not causing harm, that might up your sensitivity to your behavior in relationship to the precepts. Because maybe many of you, as I said earlier, don't go around killing and stealing. So this, what does this have to do with me, you might be wondering. So the first precept is not to kill. So for people who don't go around, actually I had a surprising experience recently at a retreat where someone was saying that, explaining, a person was talking about, I guess, a certain degree of remorse and for behavior that had been done, and what a terrible person the person was, you know, and afraid for the. And I said, well, how terrible could it be what you did? Did you kill someone? Yep. And I said, oh. Oh. I won't tell you the whole story, but it's something that happened 40, 50 years ago. So, you know, there's a whole context, you know. And I've met a few people in my life who have killed people. The first times I met someone, they did it when they were soldiers. But it was quite something to listen to them talk about their experience of running into the so-called enemy and shooting. And then, you know, I go most years, and nowadays, once a year I go to San Quentin and spend a day with lifers. Some of them are there because of murder. And there, it's interesting to go to San Quentin and hang out with a room full of murderers, because they're the safest people I know. Because the particular ones I see are the ones, I mean, you see all kinds of people in San Quentin, and you see people you don't want to, you see them and sense them and you get their vibe and you don't want to be anywhere near them. It's just so much hostility and anger and venom that seems to be part of what they are. But the particular ones I see are the ones who have gone through a whole anti-violence program, meditation, and years of inner work. And those are the ones who, you know, I feel so safe with. They, you know, they've done this amazing inner work. They become safe people. And so there are such people. One of the people I met at San Quentin, I think it was last year, was there for road rage. He killed someone on 280, so right nearby. And someone who comes to IMC here as well, a relative, was on trial for murder, road rage murder. So these things sometimes can happen very quickly and surprisingly to people who normally think that they're never going to do something like that. Anger gets the upper hand. I remember many years ago here also, we had a whole discussion about capital punishment. And Buddhism generally is very much against capital punishment because it involves murder, killing. It violates the precept. We were talking about it some, and this man stood up and said, well, I've been on both sides of that question because both my parents were killed. Murdered, but the person who murdered my parents was my brother. So, you know, so then capital punishment, you know, who's, what, where, you know. It was a big, big struggle. So there are, you know, these things do happen. For many Buddhists who were not inclined to get even close to such activity, there's simpler activities, like what do you do with insects? What do you do with the ants in your house? What do you do with bugs? What do you do with termites in your house? What do you do with gophers in your garden? What do you do with these things? Do you not kill because you're not supposed to kill anything? Or what do you do? And so you find some Buddhist teachers will say very clearly, the precept means don't kill, so you shouldn't kill even that. How I like to see this is that it's a training of the heart, so not to cause harm. And so you look into your heart to see how you need to answer that question. Because there's many, many, many issues involved about what causes harm, where the greatest problems are. And, you know, if you let the termites eat your house up and your family now out in the streets, that, I don't know, that causes a certain kind of harm too. So where's the balance? Buddhist monastics, they have really strict rules about these things. So they'll just walk away. I mean, they'll just let nature take its course. They're not going to get involved. But lay people are not monastics, so they don't have the rule. It's not so strict for them. And so then it's a matter of your heart figuring out, you know, what do you do about these kinds of questions. What I find really admirable and inspiring is that there are people who ask those questions. They don't just simply go and spray the house, you know, to get rid of all the ants. They grapple with a question, and they maybe look for alternatives rather than doing the quick answer. And so to have people who are looking for alternatives to violence is a beautiful thing. So it's not just killing, but also violence. I remember many years ago, maybe I've told this story too many times, but we used to meet in Palo Alto. A woman came up to me and after the Monday night talk, and she said, "Gil, I have to park my car in downtown Palo Alto at night sometimes. I don't feel safe. And I'm thinking of getting a gun. What do you think?" And I didn't want to say what I thought, because I don't think it's my place and my role to tell people what to do like this. But what I did tell her was, I think it's unfortunate if people go for the solution of getting a gun before they've investigated the alternatives. And there are lots of other alternatives that are comparable in making you safe to having a gun. So what inspires me is people who are willing to do the research and the thinking and the investigation and even the training that's involved to help avoid putting themselves in situations where they're going to be violent. And we don't have the draft anymore in the United States, but when I was young, we had the draft. And so I clearly was going to be a conscientious objector if I was drafted, because I was not going to be involved. I didn't want to be involved in any kind of situation where I was going to be involved in killing. So these are kind of questions that people grapple with when they look at the first precept. So how is this a training? And one of the ways it's a training is that it's a training if we can then look at our hearts, look at our minds, look at what motivates us, and use those grappling and those questions to understand ourselves better. Do we quickly go for violence? Do we quickly lash out because anger has the upper hand? Or do we use this as a way of looking at our anger or looking at our greed? You know, I don't want to give up my vegetables. I put a lot of work into my vegetables. My vegetables are really important. I'm going to get some great award for growing the biggest pumpkin. My wife grew a big pumpkin this year, and not huge, just she grew some pumpkins, and she came home one day and was gone, just completely gone. And that's a whole story, but you have your vegetables, and so someone comes and takes it away. Do you then, out of your greed for your pumpkin, do you succumb to violence? When do you succumb to violence? What's the line by which you succumb? And what motivates you to succumb to violence to get your way? So this is to ask those kinds of questions is to use the first precepts as something you train with. And in that way, what in Buddhism we like to say is that the precepts are mindfulness trainings. They're helping us be more mindful, more considerate, more conscientious about what's going on. And so when you live by the precepts, those precepts are kind of like mirrors that tell you, look more carefully. Don't just do something because it's automatic or expected, but look more carefully. When you cross this boundary, don't cross right away, look at yourself. In the Zen tradition where I trained in, there they treated these precepts as mirrors, in a sense, or signposts, that if you find yourself that you wanted to cross a precept, meaning to violate one of the precepts, stop before you do it, because what's happening is you've lost touch with your Buddha nature. You've lost touch with your innate purity or something. And so what you want to do then is you want to turn your attention around to reconnect to your peace, reconnect to your Buddha nature, your inner spiritual essence or something. And so the precepts then become this wonderful signpost, help. When you're going to break the precepts, it's a sign that you've lost touch with your spiritual essence. And so it's a wonderful kind of signpost to have. So that's the first precept. The second precept doesn't say don't steal. It's a higher kind of standard. The precept is don't take what is not given. So if it's clearly hasn't been given to you, then don't take it. Don't assume that you can just take it, even if you don't think that you're not stealing exactly, but it should be offered. And and probably none of you steal, go out steal rob banks and your neighbor's homes and stuff like that. If you want to take it on as a mindfulness training, the precept of not to steal, then you can reflect on the subtle things that you might be stealing or taking that's not given. So, I mean, it could be such small things, like you take pencils at work, for example. That could be a small example. But what about taking someone's time? You're in a conversation, and are you dominating the conversation? Are you interrupting someone when they speak? Are you taking something from them when you interrupt them? Are you taking their time when you dominate the conversation and keep talking and talking? Is that taking what's not given? How do you drive? Do you drive in such a way that you give the right of way to people? Or do you take what's not given by forcing your way in here and there? It might seem kind of petty, but what I'm trying to do is to describe how you can take on the precepts as a way of understanding yourself more. If you start looking at the subtle ways in which you might take what's not given, because then it's a way of looking and look what motivates you, what's driving you, and the fact that it might be subtle, how you drive. Maybe you're forcing yourself a little bit too fast through traffic and pushing yourself where there's no space. Maybe it's not a big deal. People do it all the time. But it's part of the way to train, to learn about what actually drives you. And can you start taking responsibility for what drives you so you can maybe let go and not be driven by things which cause harm or not to be driven by anything at all, but have more choice in what you do. And then we have the precept of not engaging in sexual misconduct. For Buddhist monastics, this means to be celibate. For people who go on retreats that we teach, generally this is also understood to be celibate. And we don't usually advertise that. Come to a 10-day celibacy retreat. And people wouldn't sign up. But that's what happens. You come there and you're expected to be celibate for the course of the retreat. And for some people, that's quite an interesting experience because it's kind of new for them, And so that becomes a mirror to understand that part of themselves much better because there's a very strong boundaries you can't cross. And so, it isn't just in sexual, activity, but it's also kind of sexual flirting and, vibing people. And so things that you can maybe get away with in ordinary life, there, in retreat, you can't. So you have to look at yourself more deeply. And so you learn about yourself and learn how to set yourself free. In daily life, for lay people, it's simply not causing harm through your sexuality. And so to be sensitive and careful about it. So if you find yourself involved in sexual activity, do you, in fact, reflect about what the consequences of the activity are going to be? Or potential consequences? Are there people who are going to be hurt by this activity? Or the fact that the consequences are completely uninteresting given how wonderful it's going to be. And I know that when I was in my teens, I didn't know that sexuality could cause harm. It just hadn't occurred to me. It was just, just something that you get as much of as you can. And then slowly and painfully, it became clear that this is a world that it's very complex and, in fact, can cause a lot of harm. And you can be hurt a lot from this as well. And so, in the sense, so to spend time reflecting and be considerate of this, it didn't come obvious to me, and maybe it all came obvious to you. You turned 14, it was obvious. But it's part of the analysis, is there some kind of harm? And even, between spouses, the question is there some kind of harm being caused here? Are you being forceful? Are there demands, in the relationship in terms of sexuality? Is this really in the spirit of this precepts to have demands and expectations and be forceful, even when, legally it's supposed to be allowed, right? And so to question, what is causing harm, and to avoid causing harm is a very important precept here. And then there's a precept of not lying. And that's a very interesting state thing, you know, because of how easy and quick many people are at making false statements or exaggerating or white lies. And so to use the precept as a mirror, where we're up against that, I'm not going to do that so readily or so quickly. Let me take a look at what's motivating me. Why am I wanting to say this? What's driving it? Then it becomes a mindfulness practice that helps us understand ourselves better. I think it's a little bit unfortunate whenever I talk about not lying as a precept, how quickly and immediately the question people ask is, well, isn't it okay to lie sometimes? Now, I think that's a valuable exploration, you know, to explore and think about. It just saddens me that's like the first question people ask. isn't there like, you know, that shouldn't be a small percentage of the time? But there is one way. One absolute in Buddhism. Buddhism doesn't have a lot of absolutes in my eyes. You know, the absolutes, you know, truths, or this like has to be this way. But one of the absolutes, that's Buddhism wouldn't exist without this absolute, is that it might be occasionally okay, appropriate or something, to lie out in the world. Maybe. You can come up with these wonderful ethical scenarios of the Nazis coming and people in your closet and, you know they do in philosophy classes. But the one absolute is that it's never okay to lie to yourself. Isn't that a nice one? And the reason why that's an absolute in Buddhism is that all of Buddhism is about waking up and being truthful, seeing clearly. I think of mindfulness, a synonym for mindfulness practice is being honest. Being honest about what's going on right now. It's a quest to be as honest as you can here in the present moment to yourself. This is what's going on. This is what's motivating me. This is what I'm feeling. This is what's happening around me. So in order to do Buddhist practice, Buddhism doesn't work if we're intentionally lying to ourselves. Or I don't know how many people intentionally lie to themselves, but I think there's plenty of delusion and deceit that goes on. And then the final precept is the precept of not having to do with no intoxication. Now, the Pali, this is fun, and this is controversial, so you get my point of view. I asked Ajahn Amaro this question, and he said, no way, there's no controversy. It's very clear what this precept means. So he said, the people say it's absolutely one way, say, the precept says, not to take any intoxicating drugs or drinks, more or less, I should say. So don't take any. There's some linguists, grammarians of the ancient tradition, say actually the grammar is ambiguous. And it could say, don't take any drugs and alcohol to the point of getting intoxicated. So which is it? And so depending on where you fall on that line, you might make different kind of decision. Some people might say, well, the precept is don't drink at all. And some people say, well, social drinking, as long as you're not even tipsy, it's okay. Just a little sip is okay. So I think that's for you to decide. Again, in Buddhism, there's no absolute authority that says you should do this in one particular way. But what causes the least amount of harm, again, is the principle. And to be really honest about it. I think this is an area where there's some kind of where, I don't know if honesty is the right word, but where delusion comes into play. We feel that, just a little drink here and there and another one here and there, you know, it's no harm done. And then pretty soon, harm is done. So say something, do something that you later regret. But the more interesting, one of the interesting questions in that this precept is supposed to help us be mindful, mindfulness training, perhaps any kind of intoxication goes against the grain, goes against what we're trying to do, if what we're trying to do is to make the mind clear. Clear and independent, not dependent on any substance or anything for our well-being. And as soon as you start using a substance for our well-being, then you've abdicated responsibility for doing that inner work yourself and turning in and looking. And also, what's interesting, I think, also very significant, I think, is the way in which the precepts are gifts to our society. It's a way of supporting other people, too. And there's a tremendous amount number of people in our society who are struggling with addiction issues, with alcohol and drug addictions. And there's some people, you know, it takes tremendous strength and courage sometimes and fortitude to kind of, you know, stay sober. And I think it's a beautiful thing for the rest of us to support that. I recently went to a big event, kind of a fundraising dinner, a big thing in San Francisco. And I was so surprised how much wine there was, because it's not in my world, the alcohol thing. And I was just, it felt kind of strange. And I think, you know, it's unfortunate because of the people who struggle with addiction issues. It's best to kind of try, you know, avoid, support them. Don't make it easier for them. Don't make it harder for them to avoid. So in terms of being a gift to others, in that it's such a huge social issue, there's some ways in which it's a gift to the world around you to limit or restrict or to stop your use of alcohol. Show that it's possible to others. It's not just for your own sake, but maybe for the sake of your society around you. And then, as a mindfulness training for yourself, when you find yourself about to want to take a drink or take some kind of recreational drug, to stop and look carefully. What's motivating you? What are the intentions? What are the feelings? What are the consequences for doing this? To keep using this stuff, using all this as introspection, to look more deeply. Now, I can imagine that there are some people who can do the introspective work well and might decide that certain kind of, altering substance might be appropriate for what they're trying to do. Maybe it's, you know, they're taking peyote for a Native American ritual, and it's part of the ritual practice to do that. But the Buddhist thing would be to look introspective, to question, is there harm being caused here? Not to do things unconsciously, without introspection, without consideration, without reflection. So of course you're completely free not to pay any heed to these five precepts and just meditate away. But I'll warn you then that if you meditate away, your heart's going to become more sensitive. And if your heart becomes more sensitive, you're going to be more tuned in to harm and how harm is caused and how harm is felt and experienced and occurs around you. And you'll want to do something about that. And as you want to do something about that, I think you'll become one of those people who will tend to want to live so that someone else could say, oh, look to that person there. She's not killing, stealing, involved in sexual misconduct, lying, or involved in misuse of alcohol and drugs. And you might look like you're living by the precepts, but you know better. You're not living by them. You're not living by them, you're living them. So I hope that as you mature and grow and become a more heartfelt, open-hearted person, that you live the precepts more than living by them. So, thank you.